Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us for this latest edition of the OIES podcast series. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute. And it's my great pleasure to be joined today by Bruce Moore from Howe Robinson Partners to discuss the key messages that came out of his chapter, The Role of Ammonia and Hydrogen in Meeting International Maritime Organization Targets for Decarbonizing Shipping. That was published in the May 2021 Oxford Institute of Energy Studies Energy Forum magazine. Now, just to timestamp this recording in the ever-changing market we live in, we are recording this podcast on the morning of Tuesday, the 22nd of June, 2021. Bruce, welcome to the OIES podcast series.
Hello, David, and thanks for inviting me. Very happy to be here.
Well, look, Bruce, now, can we start perhaps by giving an overview of the shipping sector? You know, how big is the emissions problem? How is the industry regulated? And you know, why have emissions from shipping become so difficult to decarbonize?
It's a great set of questions there, David. I mean, I think it's worth reminding ourselves just how big the shipping sector really is. I mean, because so far, so much of shipping happens out of sight, out of mind, on the high seas and international waters. I mean, about 11 billion tons of goods are transported by sea each year. That's about 1.5 tons for each one of us. And there's about $14 trillion worth of value in the world shipping markets each year. And they move about 2 billion tons of coal, about 1 billion tons of iron ore, there or thereabouts, 350 million tons of grain. So that's a lot of ships moving over long distance very quickly. Unfortunately, that's where the greenhouse gas emissions come in, because that amount of steel moving around the world takes a lot of energy. And at the moment, almost all of that energy is derived from hydrocarbons. So the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that come from shipping is about 2.9% of the total worldwide man's greenhouse gas emissions. It's almost the same as Germany. So it's quite significant in terms of the amount of greenhouse gases as a species that we're responsible for. And that corresponds to about 0.9 gigatons per year. Now, one of the problems here is that as the world trade increases, well, so does the volume of shipping, the amount of goods that needs to be moved around the world. And the IEA recently forecast that if we carry on our business as usual, if we don't do anything, then actually that 0.9 gigatons will probably increase to around 1.7 gigatons by 2050. So, of course, that's way out of line with all our sort of various international targets, and particularly the Paris Climate Accord and everything we're trying to do at COP to try and bring down greenhouse gas emissions. So it really is a significant issue that the industry needs to address.
And as you say, Bruce, many of it is out of sight of anybody because, of course, the ships are at sea all the time. So I expect my next question has to be, you know, how can material gains in decarbonisation actually be achieved in the shipping sector?
The biggest gain, as ever, it's a bit of a boring one, but it's really significant and really important. Slow down. So it's kind of the same as the biggest gains we can make in our own homes is actually put a sweater on and turn that thermostat down. It's a boring answer, but it's the same with ships. Now, you might think, well, if your ships slow down, don't you need more ships because you've still got the same amount of stuff that needs to be moved around? But actually, the relationship between speed and consumption isn't linear. So if you add 10% to your speed, you need to add more than 10% to your fuel consumption. So actually, there's quite a bit of scope for actually slowing down. So there are very, very material gains that can be made. And the regulator, or the international regulator for shipping that has most power over the industry, is the International Maritime Organization, which is part of the UN, although it's a very, very complicated industry with all sorts of regulatory bodies. And the IMO has set its own initial greenhouse gas strategy. In fact, there's been a recent meeting of the MEPC, the Marine Environment Protection Committee, as an update on that. A lot of what it's tried to, the targets that have set are not just about different fuels, which we know we'll need. Certainly the biggest gains that can be made is around some of those operational measures, like slowing down, like trying to reduce congestions in ports, like trying to manage voyages better. So that's one of the material gains that can be made. Ultimately, though, even if we slow down, even if we manage our voyages, even if you try and decongest all those ports and reduce waiting time for ships, the ships are still burning hydrocarbons as a fuel, and that's the part that needs to be addressed.
Okay, but surely, you know, the IMO is actually addressing this because it recently cut sulfur in fuel to 0.5% from the 1st of January 2020. And this was a major step forward. And it also has other targets to set out to 2050. You know, so I expect my question is, you know, is the pace of change fast enough?
Well, and that's absolutely right, David. I mean, that was a really significant change. And it was great from the IMO to see that very big reduction in the amount of allowable sulfur and fuel. But that was all about, wasn't about greenhouse gases. That was about reducing the amount of acid rain, about acidification of the oceans. That sulfur traditionally, as we say, was burnt by ships out of sight, out of mind on international oceans because there was nothing else we could do with it on land. We're now removing it at refineries and disposing of it safely, which that's a great step forward, but not in terms of the Paris Climate Accord and trying to reduce greenhouse gases. So what the IMO have done in terms of their initial greenhouse gas strategy is said they want to set the strategy with the target of reducing absolute level of emissions from the industry by 50% by 2050 with respect to what those emissions were back in 2008. Now, of course, because the volume of trade will increase during that period, it's not actually a 50% per ship or 50% per ton mile. It's actually more like an 85% reduction in what we call carbon intensity. So, you know, in terms of the amount of emissions on average emitted by particular vessels over a particular mile has to be reduced by drastically over that period.
But in your excellent chapter, you list out different lower emission shipping fuels, and then you go on to compare 9 against HFO. So can we talk about some of these different fuels that now in this kind of section of the podcast? So why don't we start to talk about, you know, electricity, including batteries as a fuel? Is that a possibility to get the emissions down?
Well, that would be absolutely fabulous, because batteries, in terms of trying to capture that energy from renewably generated power from, say, wind and solar and use it on ships, batteries would be the most efficient way to do that. Rather than go via intermediary steps of actually trying to manufacture fuels and try to contain them in terms of ammonia or hydrogen. Unfortunately, batteries that would be required for these big ships moving over long distances of the deep sea are just enormous. You know, right now, they're bigger than the engine rooms of the ships and very, very heavy. So whilst we're seeing some great steps forward on shore in terms of battery technology and use in power grids, it doesn't look like it within the foreseeable future that we'll be able to use batteries for the big ships over long distances. Well, what we are seeing on battery technology is some really good uptake on some short sea shipping. So, for example, ferries around Scandinavia, where there's lots of renewable sort of hydropower. And that's great to see some of that short sea shipping adopting batteries, but probably not for the foreseeable future in terms of the bigger ships.
It's interesting, in the electrical vehicle sector, right? I've got an electric car, of course. The shorter distances are the optimum take-up, where if you kind of have a regular basis to go longer distances, it's challenging, which sounds very similar to shipping. And another fuel, of course, that's being discussed a lot at the moment is hydrogen. So what about hydrogen as a potential fuel to reduce the carbon footprint of shipping?
Yeah, and indeed, hydrogen really has a lot of potential advantages as well. Of course, you know, if we get hydrogen on board a ship or even an aeroplane to use as a fuel or anywhere as a fuel, you actually use that fuel via combustion. So you combine it with oxygen somehow, either in an internal combustion engine or in a fuel cell. It doesn't really matter ultimately. So hydrogen won't be a way in terms of liquefying. For big ships, we need liquefied hydrogen in a tank in terms of getting that amount of energy onto a ship to move it over longer distances. Unfortunately, the engineering challenges involved in liquid hydrogen are vast. We're talking minus 240 degrees centigrade. It's not that far above absolute zero. Special metals, the hydrogen tends to leak through all sorts of ordinary welds and pipes. Compressed hydrogen is possible, but again, really, there's really just for short sea shipping and for smaller ships. So it's not impossible. In fact, there's a fantastic little ship called the Susio Frontier. It's a 1,250 cubic meter ship being built in Japan right now. In fact, it has been built and delivered as a kind of test case to try and move renewably generated hydrogen from Australia to Japan. And that's a real step forward, but it does look like it's going to be quite difficult in terms of engineering challenges to use liquid hydrogen on big ships, although a lot of people have a lot of faith in it ultimately. So it's certainly not a near-case solution. It's more of a longer aspiration, I would say.
Okay, well, in your chapter, of course, you know, you link hydrogen with ammonia. So let's talk about ammonia now. Is that a realistic solution?
And ammonia, a lot of people put a lot of faith into ammonia within, I would say, the medium term. And this is where we get really interested now, because there's there's a lot of uncertainty with regards to any long-term forecast, but the ammonia in terms of looks technically achievable in terms of we can take that renewably generated hydrogen, combine it via very conventional processes. It's called Haber-Bosch process by which we manufacture ammonia. Store that at only minus 33 degrees centigrade, not minus 240 like hydrogen, so it's containable. Can be used on a ship. Now, the disadvantage of ammonia is it's highly toxic, it's corrosive, it has low flammability, so you need to add something else to actually make it go bang within an engine cylinder. And its energy density, and this is a theme we'll come back to several times, its energy density is nowhere near as high as heavy fuel oil, but it does look technically achievable. Now, a lot would have to happen first for it to be adopted by the whole maritime industry. It would have a whole value chain of it, ammonia as bunkering ships, of bunkering facilities at ports, and in fact, the fuel tanks on the ships would be very, very big. So it's not going to be easy. So it's definitely not a short-term solution, ammonia, but it looks like a technically achievable, I'll keep saying this, technically achievable medium-term solution. The very, really big sort of uncertainty over it is actually more of a commercial uncertainty, and I'm sure we'll come back to that. It's how do we pay for all this energy transition? So there's actually a really big commercial question over ammonia.
Yeah, and that, as you said, we will come back to that in a minute. But before we do that, let's talk about some of the other different fuel options, and you know, biofuels and methanol. These are a couple more. Do you want to perhaps share your views on those?
And biofuels, again, look interesting, probably more for specific uses. There's been a very mixed kind of historic publicity with regards to biofuels in general. Of course, some biofuels are great. We've been capturing biomethane for small-scale use on farms for a long time, and that's great. That genuinely reduces CO2. Cutting down rainforests to plant palm oil to turn into diesel is terribly destructive. And of course, hopefully we've moved on from that. So if we are going to use biofuels, they need to be produced sustainably. They shouldn't be competing with fuel production. And really, it's about using more farming and food waste products like lignin-based products. One of the advantages of biofuels is their energy density. To a certain extent, they look like fuel oil. They're a bit similar to fuel oil chemically for the most part. There are some caveats around that. But ultimately, the limitation of biofuel, once we get past the cost argument, which wouldn't be too bad, is more about the sustainability and actually how much of the stuff will be available. So that you would need a lot of fuel to change fuel oil and shipping. So that's my concern with biofuel. So it will have its uses, but maybe not enough availability for the long term. Similar argument to methanol. So, you know, so there are some big believers in methanol. Maersk, for example, has said they're not big fans of LNG as fuel. They're putting a lot of money into methanol. Ultimately, use of methanol can reduce greenhouse gases by about 10% versus fuel oil, which is great, a step forward, but it's still only 10%. Ultimately, it will only really work for decarbonisation if you can produce that methanol either synthetically from hydrogen or from biological sources. And again, we'll be limited by that availability of the prime feedstock.
Okay, now, of course, the one fuel which is very close to my heart and is already being used in quite a lot of shipping is LNG. And so, you know, is that a long-term solution or is it just kind of an interim solution? What are your views on that?
Well, it's certainly available right now. And there are, again, there's a lot of believers of this in the industry, and there are ship owners who are investing now, and there's bunker suppliers are investing now in a value chain that's been developing now for a good 10 or 15 years. And depending on how you actually measure the ships and their capability, 10 to 20% of the ships being built right now, tankers, bulkers, containers, are actually LNG powered or can be LNG powered or ready to be LNG converted for LNG powered. So a lot of believers in this industry. The reason for that is that although it is still a hydrocarbon, is that it burns very cleanly, almost no SOx emissions, so sulfur oxide emissions, NOx emissions can be abated and are either vastly reduced or can be abated in very conventional ways. And then the greenhouse gas emissions are potentially around 25% reduction. Now, it's still a hydrocarbon, you've still got a big 75% problem, and that's where the long-term problem comes in. But if we said to the world, we can reduce world emissions tomorrow by 25%, we'd all be beaming from ear to ear, of course. And that's where, because some of the alternatives are going to take so long to come in any kind of practical sense, that's why there's so many believers in LNG as a fuel right now. It's not universal, but there's a lot of people investing a lot of money in LNG as a fuel on ships. There will be continued controversy, I would say, and there's more and more attention to being paid to the way that LNG is generated along its whole value chain from the upstream, from the emissions from wells, from the midstream actually delivering to ships, and then you not just using on the ships. So not just, as we say, the tank to wake and the emissions on the ships, but actually the well to wake, the whole value chain. And that's where ultimately the 25%, all of that needs to work for the 25% to be delivered. But it's people are investing it now because it's available today and very little else is for big ships.
Okay, well, looking forward now, there are some others which you do address in your article, LPG, nuclear, for example. We did address batteries and fuel cells a bit earlier on. Now, anything we need to know about that? Nuclear seems logical, but I would have thought politically quite difficult.
Yes, a lot of people will get very nervous about lots of nuclear reactors floating around. Say there is a lot of interest in what we're calling now the new generation nuclear reactors. They're based on something called molten salt. In fact, the Bill Gates Foundation is invested in this quite heavily, for onshore necessarily, but to be honest, there are a lot of potential safety aspects. But yes, it's a very long-term possible solution, and it would have to get past the public perception. To be honest, the biggest thing that's in favour of nuclear, quite apart from the reduction, is, and if this goes to the same with electric ships and to a certain extent with hydrogen, certainly the fuel cell ships, is if we can get ships electrically driven rather than via internal combustion engines, they become much simpler to construct and operate. And safety benefits are enormous, the operability is enormous. Those of electric who have electric cars will find this. They're simpler beasts to work with. An internal combustion engine is an amazing thing. They're very, very efficient, but they're quite complicated and they vibrate and they're noisy, and electrically driven stuff is just generally simpler.
Okay, so we've talked through the different options, and it's very clear with that. But can you perhaps share with our listeners how you compare these different fuels? Because you did mention energy density as an overriding key factor, and also there are different shipping sectors, short sea and deep sea. So I think my question is, is there one fuel solution for all sectors?
Well, I think you've almost answered it there. There won't be. I think there's already really great solutions being adopted for some of these short sea shipping routes and some of the specialist ships. For the big traditional international shipping sectors, containers, bulkers, tankers, they all face the same problem. Huge ship got to be moved relatively quickly over long distance, and you've got to carry your fuel with you. You can't just connect to the power grid. So that's where energy density comes in. You've got to have a tank of something, of your fuel, that's dense enough to be carried on board a ship. And we're going to the technicalities now. We can see in the report how you can rank all those fuels, but heavy fuel oil is actually very energy dense. So in a small fuel tank can move a large ship a long way relatively quickly. LNG tanks start to become kind of 50-60% bigger. Ammonia tanks, you're talking 3 or 4 times bigger, hydrogen 5 times bigger. It becomes actually quite a problem on the ship accommodating the size of the tank, but all technically achievable, I would say, before we get onto the more commercial issues, but that's where energy density comes in. And I would say one last comment on that. Shipping's difficult. Aviation's, I would say, harder. And we'll come back to that a little bit anyway, because some of the solutions that it may be that some solutions we want to adopt, like biofuels that go into ships, have to be reserved for aviation, because it's going to be very, very hard to decarbonize the world of aviation.
Actually, you do raise a very good point, of course. This is going to be a holistic solution. It's going to be all the sectors having to work together to be able to come up with a satisfactory solution for the world and indeed the global environment. But I want to come back, if I can, to something you said earlier on about the role of operational efficiencies, because it strikes me as something very simple, really, to be able to achieve. Is that key in getting emissions down?
It is, I would say. It's very, very important. To be honest, a lot of it has been done. So the big obvious areas about operational efficiencies are reducing speed, trying to get better voyage planning. So avoiding storms, for example, getting to port just in time to go into that port, not getting to port and then just hanging around for 3 days until a space appears for you. And then reducing the congestion in port so that actually ships can get in. Because of the sort of relatively difficult economic times of late, and to be honest, the varying cycle since 2007, 2008, that's slowing down shipping, to be honest, is actually a lot of it's happened already. So we'll touch on this in the article, but one of the detailed policies the IMO introduced is something called EEXI, which is about operational efficiency. It's exactly this. It's about reducing fuel consumption from existing ships. The biggest ways our owners can comply with that is slow down, but they've kind of slowed down to a large degree already. So yes, it's important, but it's already happening.
Okay, well, we've alluded a couple of times during this podcast of the commercial aspects. I'd like to address that now if I can, because we haven't really talked about the pace of change yet. You know, how fast will the change take? And, you know, the million-dollar question, you know, at what cost and who pays? So perhaps you can give us some insights there, Bruce.
So the pace of change is a fascinating one in that the IMO is our big overarching shipping regulatory body. If we're really going to do anything worldwide, it has to be through the only organisation which really governs shipping worldwide. That said, the IMO, to be fair, is traditionally quite a bureaucratic, some would say slow-moving enterprise, because it has over 140 different countries. It's a difficult thing to move very quickly. And there's been some frustration expressed by bodies such as the European Union, for example, within the pace of change of the IMO. A lot of the things down to cost and who pays and pace, for me, comes down to not just changing technology, but actually how quickly we can actually make some quite difficult commercial decisions. So right now, it's fabulous what's happening with solar power and with wind. They're getting cheaper than coal and oil anyway. So to be honest, it's like the world would decarbonize to that extent where it can, because they're economically cheaper. Ammonia and hydrogen on ships will never compete with fuel oil. They just can't. There's just too much thermodynamics and chemistry in the way. So if we're ever going to make these alternative fuels work, we need things like either carbon trading or carbon pricing, some kind of what we call market-based measures to really push this forward. So when we say, how will the pace of change go? To be honest, how quickly can the world make some quite difficult commercial decisions to try and push this? Now, there's a lot of bodies trying to pull this together, a lot from some organizations like the Getting to Zero Coalition, kind of names in the title, to traders like Trafigura, for example, very much in favor, and the oil majors very much in favor of carbon trading and carbon levies. So we need to make some pace of change all related to more commercial and political decisions, not necessarily changes in technology. Technology will help, but we can solve carbon, we can solve the climate crisis tomorrow if we want to, and maybe with carbon capture. It's just that nobody pays you to put CO2 under the ground yet. So there are some, you know, a lot of organizations, you know, the IMO is doing a lot of work on this, but pace of change is a big deal. The cost of actually bringing all this about is a really interesting question. And there's a number of studies that have estimated this to say by 2050, if we want to comply with that IMO target, we're talking of the order of $1 trillion, 0.8 to 1, the study said 0.8 to $1.2 trillion. $40 to $60 billion over 20 years. Now, that's a vast amount of money. You think, well, who's going to pay for that? Well, the answer to that is actually very simple. It's you and I. The cost of moving ships around is paid for within the price of the end goods that the consumer buys. Now, happily, in that regard, the price of end goods, is the price of freight is quite a small element of that. So the price of oil delivered to a refinery, the price of freight, that's quite a small element. The price of, I know, some computers delivered by container, price of freight is relatively small. So increase in price of freight shouldn't actually make that much of a dent. In fact, one statistic which I thought was great on this, I saw in one study that said if a pair of jeans is delivered to the US from China by container, and that pair of jeans costs the end consumer $60, then all of these changes in shipping would affect that by around 80 cents. So in that regard, it's relatively simple and achievable, but there's some very big, very difficult political commercial decisions that need to actually happen before all that comes about.
Well, why do we jump to that in my last question of this podcast? Because I always like to end up with a kind of forward-thinking kind of question. And I was really drawn to the concluding line of your article, which was really insightful. And if I may quote, you know, the shipping industry is fragmented geographically and between sectors. Its immediate priorities must be on ways to more quickly bring about a mix of commercial incentives and regulatory change that results in tangible emissions reductions. So, you know, the question is, you know, so can we end up perhaps this podcast with you sharing with us, you know, where will this all end up? How will we get there? What are the steps? And importantly, you know, will the end consumers pay?
If there's one simple element to that, the end consumers will pay. Ultimately, the shipping industry is paid for by the consumers of the goods. And so that's quite simple. I wish there was a more of a simple answer to the main part of the question, to be honest, is, you know, how can we actually bring this about and how can we work? I think there'll be a real mixture between regulatory push. So, for example, the European Union, the IMO, putting regulations in place, but also I would say regulatory pull from cargo owners, from ship owners, from financial institutions, from the public. You know, all that kind of consumer pull will have to actually be just as important as any kind of regulatory push. So from everything from even the sort of COP meeting in Glasgow later in the year, the MEPC meetings in the IMO, all of these consumer bodies are really going to have to push together to try and make this work. My own personal suspicion is that the market pull may actually start to overtake to a certain degree some of the regulatory push, and some of the regulators are really going to have to keep up. But that's no bad thing.
No, that's no bad thing at all. No, so, well, look, Bruce, you know, we could carry on chatting about this fascinating subject for far, far longer, but unfortunately, we've run out of time, as one always does on these podcast recordings. So, you know, thank you very much for your time today. And also, can I say thank you very much for writing the article itself in the Oxford Energy Forum that was published recently by the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.